This is Dr. Jay Corsandi, and you're listening to The Best Night Ever, the show that's dedicated to helping you get your best night's sleep. Over the last 20 years of treating patients, I've worn many hats, including dentist, engineer, psychologist, artist, corporate executive, and more. I've found that the key to success, health, and longevity lies in sleep, and that's why I created this show. I want to teach you how to make sleep your best friend. Join me on a journey to uncover cutting-edge science, life-changing tips from renowned experts, ancient and modern sleep secrets, game-changing routines, and lifestyle hacks that will educate, inspire, and ultimately help you get the best night ever. Hey, welcome back, everyone. It's Dr. Jay Corsandi, and I think we can all agree that if we don't breathe, we don't live. But have you given much thought on how you breathe? Have you heard of the term functional breathing? This is one of those episodes where I get to geek out with a pioneer in the world of functional breathing. His name is Patrick McEwen, and if you've ever wondered about breathing, you may have read one of his books called Close Your Mouth or The Oxygen Advantage. Patrick McEwen is widely regarded as one of the world's leading breathing re-education experts. He's been on just about every major health and wellness podcast, including my favorites, Bulletproof Radio, Ben Greenfield, London Real, and many, many more. He's also a TEDx presenter, so you're going to want to listen to what this guy has to say. He really knows what he's talking about. So a quick warning on this show, we did a really deep dive into sleep apnea medicine and talked about things like arousal thresholds and loop gain, which got pretty technical in the first half of the show. However, it is a fascinating look into the science of sleep and breathing, but if it is too technical, you can fast forward to the second half where we talk about mouth taping, breathing for performance, kids and breathing, why breathing hard and yoga may not be the best idea, and a lot more. This show was brought to you by me, and if you want to support the show, please share or tag a friend online and include me so I can share it as well. You can find me on Instagram at sleepbiohacker, or you can also visit my website, sleepbiohacker.com, to see all the products that I've talked about in the past and on this show. So I invite you to take a small breath in through your nose, not deep, and a small exhale. Sit back, relax, and on to the show. Okay, we are live. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Dr. Jay. Good to be here.
So you and I are both what they call airway advocates, or as our friend James Nestor calls pulmonauts, which I thought is a great word. But you didn't suddenly wake up one day and say, I'm going to help people breathe better. You know, can you share a little bit about your journey and how you are, where you're at now and how it all started?
Sure, of course. I came across this field completely by accident, and I came across it 22 years ago. I was a kid growing up with asthma, and if you have asthma, you don't just have asthma. You're more likely to have a stuffy nose because inflammation will travel from the lungs up to the nose. And if you have a stuffy nose or if you have impairment of nasal breathing, you're more likely to be a mouth breather. So I was a snorer and a bad one. And I was also told that I was stopping breathing during sleep. And I was also waking up tired every morning. So, but you kind of learn to live with it. That's the way it is. But I remember falling asleep in high school. And I also remember when I was in university, for me to get grades, I had to study a lot harder than my peers. And it wasn't necessarily because I wasn't intelligent, but I didn't have the concentration and I didn't have the focus and energy levels. So I came across the importance of nasal breathing in a newspaper article back in 1998. And it was based on the work of a Russian doctor, Dr. Konstantin Buteyko. And he said two things. He said, your breathing should be in and out through your nose. And he said, your breathing should be light. It shouldn't be hard. And I was doing neither of those things. I was constantly having my mouth open, exercise with my mouth open, sleeping with my mouth open, watching television, my mouth was open. So my mouth was open. And of course, it's not that your mouth is open 100% of the time, but you do spend a lot more time breathing through an open mouth than through your nose. And the reason being is because of the feeling of air hunger. So I read that article, and that night I practiced the nose unblocking exercise. You can hold your, open up your nose by holding your breath. And I was able to decongest my nose. I kept on practicing it. And that night, I wore Breathe Right strips across my nose and I wore paper tape across my mouth. And the first morning, yeah, I was kind of getting used to it. Not a whole lot of a difference. But I continued doing the exercises into the second day, wore the Breathe Right strip on my nose that night and tape on my mouth. And I woke up and it was the best night's sleep that I had that I could ever remember. And my wheezing was reducing, I would say, about 50% in that week. So I knew then that I was onto something, but my training is in economics. I was never going to work in this field. It was 2 years later, I decided that I would like to change careers. And that's what happened.
And it's amazing when you say that experiment that you discovered. You know, I treat patients for snoring and sleep apnea. These are people who can't breathe at night. And when I put them on a CPAP machine, they literally have that same experience that you had, is like this huge awakening the next day. Oh, you know, oh my God, I haven't slept like that in 5 years. They have this clarity, this awake functioning, which is like, it blows me away every single time. And it's such a magical, huge transformation. So we're going to get into all kinds of things related to sleep and breathing and all kinds of good stuff. So I'm excited. One of the things that people say when they come to see me, probably one of the first, they call it chief complaints, is I can't breathe through my nose. And I know you alluded to it a little bit here. Why is this happening to so many people? And can you walk me through a typical scenario from childhood to adulthood and how this progresses?
Yeah, there's a lot of variables in this, and we're not always sure like what's the cause and what's the effect. And sometimes there's a chicken and the egg scenario. So you can have a young infant born with a very narrow palate, with a palate, an elevated palate as well, which is already infringing on the cavity. And maybe because in the womb that the young infant was sucking its thumb. So, you know, different forces can influence the shape of the face. And I think there's a genetic component here as well. I have a very high palate, but my parents didn't. And I had very narrow jaws as well. And I used to have the black triangles either side. And Dr. William Hang, Dr. John Mew, who did some expansion, some forward growth, etc. And my daughter, though, has tetogenesis. So she is congenitally missing teeth. And here is an issue, because we know when the mouth is too small, the problem is that the mouth is too small to house the tongue. And there is an increased risk then of that tongue encroaching on the airway. You know, I think there's many factors in terms of what's causing mouth breathing. You know, lack of breastfeeding could be one due to societal pressures. Very poor awareness in identifying tongue ties, for example. The other aspect of it is that, say, for instance, children who do undergo tonsillectomy and adenoidectomy, there tends not to be any follow-up with these children in terms of restoring nasal breathing. And so I think part of it is that there's very little awareness on restoring nasal breathing, both in the pediatric and adult population. And it's a vicious circle, because if, for example, when one switches to nasal breathing, if we feel that we are not getting enough air through the nose, we are not going to use it. So any child or adult, if they feel air hunger by breathing through the nose, they will automatically and unconsciously switch to mouth breathing. So what is causing the air hunger? Well, it could be allergic rhinitis. The nose is just stuffy, you know, it could be perennial rhinitis. And that's relatively easy to address. And, you know, people might say, well, how is it so easy? Well, the one thing about our own experience, the more we breathed through it, the better it worked, the more we used it. But most people don't use it when they have air hunger. Another aspect to take into consideration is the anatomy of the nose. If one just has a smaller nasal airway, that in turn could generate air hunger. It might be perfectly adequate. Their nose may be functioning perfectly, but if it's a little bit smaller, they're more likely then, there's a tendency, if it's generating air hunger, that they switch to mouth breathing. Another factor, of course, in the adult population is that 60% of the adult population can have some form of deviated septum, where the bone and cartilage is dividing one side of the nose to the other is crooked or is off. And another one then would be breathing pattern disorders. So for example, if we have a tendency for people to breathe a little bit faster and a little bit upper chest, that their breathing rate and minute ventilation, the amount of air that they breathe per minute, if it's in excess of what it should be, if they have a chronic breathing pattern disorder, that too can generate a feeling of air hunger, that they don't feel comfortable breathing through the nose. And of course, once you switch to mouth breathing, that's only going to reinforce the whole thing. So it's a habit. And it's a habit whereby there has been very little awareness of it in today's modern society of the importance of nasal breathing. It's almost as if, you know, the nose doesn't perform any function that the mouth can perform. But if we look at the anatomy, and quite simply, if we look at the anatomy of the mouth, what does the mouth do in terms of breathing? Is there any function provided by the mouth to the air that's coming into the lungs? And the answer is no. The mouth performs zero functions. And yet when we look at the size of the nasal cavity and we look at the moistening effect, warmth, regulating volume, harnessing nasal nitric oxide, and as Dr. Morse Cottle said back in the 1970s, the human nose performs 30 functions in the human body. So it's very, very interesting. And, you know, there's many anomalies here, you know, in terms of a lot going together, but it seems that the shape of the human face is getting smaller. The jaws are becoming a little bit more set back, and we have no room for error here, because a decent airway is only about the size of a garden hose pipe or the size of our thumb. And if we have any encroachment of the airway, we're going to be in trouble.
Yeah, it's interesting because I have this discussion with a lot of parents when they come in here and a lot of adults in general. And like you said, it's kind of the chicken or the egg. You know, were you not using your nose, so then you went to revert to mouth breathing? Was it seasonal allergies? Was it, you know, dental alveolar growth and development? Was it genetic from your parents, a high palate, deviated septum? I mean, it goes on and on. But we do know that all of these things contribute to a chronic lifelong progression of mouth breathing, you know, nasal obstruction, deviated septum. And let's talk, you know, we've obviously been mentioning here the benefits of nose breathing and the disadvantages of mouth breathing. And you've mentioned, you know, we get so much more from the nose, things like nitric oxide. Can we talk a little bit more about, I guess, nitric oxide and the disadvantages of mouth breathing, how you don't really get anything other than a dry mouth in the morning? And air hunger as well, too. I also want to touch a little bit more on that.
Yeah, like even looking at sleep apnea, it's very understudied. And there has been papers looking at when, for example, the adult population, when they undergo surgery for their nose, or if they, for instance, they're taking nasal steroids, or if they're using breathe right strips, which would be a nasal dilator. The researchers often conclude that chronic nasal obstruction plays a minor role in sleep disorder breathing. And here's the issue here. The researchers are looking at the impact of surgery on the nose. They are looking at the impact of using nasal steroids for the nose, or they are looking at the impact of using a nasal dilator. But in the papers, they don't actually ask the question if the individuals are breathing through their nose during sleep. And that was one of those things. How can you draw a conclusion on the role of nasal obstruction unless you are actually asking the question, is this individual breathing through their nose or not during sleep? My own personal story, in 1994, I had an operation on my nose. As you see, my nose is still all over the place. But it's a lot better now than it was 20-odd years ago. But the surgeon never told me to breathe through it. So from 1994 to 1998, I'd having the same problems. And, you know, with regards, if we look at the functions of the nose as the organ that's the first line of the defense, and even in times that we're talking about today with COVID, I would much rather be in a busy place with my mouth closed, breathing very lightly in the nose in order just to reduce viral load, as opposed to be there with the mouth open, taking that air straight into the airways. Nitric oxide, it is known that it's antiviral, although I'm not sure if the nitric oxide in the human nose has it been tested in humans. It seems to have been that the studies are coming from animals. But it is known that nitric oxide is antiviral, it's antibacterial. It also serves a role in redistributing the blood throughout the lungs. And this helps in terms of improving ventilation perfusion, in other words, the gas exchange from the lungs into the blood. And back in 1988, a researcher, they looked at individuals who had their jaws wired shut post-jaw surgery, and they were forced to continue breathing through the nose. The PO2 in the blood increased by 10%. Now, there was a very interesting paper published in Laryngoscope just a few months ago, and what I'm going to do is actually, I'm not sure if you can give me share screen.
Yeah.
But if I could show you the paper, because I think it's important that even though the studies haven't yet come out, and I would say more so that science hasn't caught up with it. And I'm looking for my pen, but so, for example, looking at this paper here, which was published, so it's a recent enough publication, and they looked at 95 individuals with obstructive sleep apnea, and they were recruited in the study from May 2017 to May 2019. Now, the conclusion was that mouth breathing was significantly associated with worse oxygen desaturation and increased degree of upper airway collapse. Now, if we scroll down and if we look at the stats on this, so for example, with mouth breathing, and 11 subjects were mouth breathing, 45 years of age, but the AHI index with mouth breathing was 52 events per hour.
Huge.
Now, if we look at oronasal breathing, so the individuals are likely switching from mouth to nose or maybe breathing combined, there were 49 subjects who were breathing nose and mouth. The average age was 51, and the AHI index was 42 events per hour, which is still severe. Now, nasal breathing, 35 subjects were breathing through their nose. And the average age here was 48 years of age, and the AHI was 27 events per hour. Now, I know 27 events, you're still borderline on severe sleep apnea, but there is a significant difference between 27 events per hour and 52 events. Now, what's more, if we look at the minimal drop to blood oxygen saturation here, the SaO2%, we see with mouth breathing, it dropped to 64.18%. Now, I work with elite athletes, and we have them do breath hold training, and we use it as a stressor to force the body to make adaptations. With elite athletes who can endure a really, really long breath hold time, they would have difficulty dropping down to 64%. But yet these individuals are doing it unconsciously in their sleep. Now, what would typically point here is that their breathing is so unstable because of mouth breathing as well, which is contributing to a phenotype called loop gain, that the individuals are stopping breathing and that they've got an exaggerated ventilatory response towards minimal changes of carbon dioxide, that when they do resume breathing, they resume breathing with really hard and heavy breathing, which blows off a lot of carbon dioxide from the blood through the lungs. And as a result, the brain doesn't send the stimulus to breathe, and they have a really long breath hold time. Because in order for you to drop your blood oxygen saturation to 64%, you need to be able to hold your breath for a long, long time. Now, the drop to blood oxygen saturation for the oronasal group was 77%, and for the nasal breathing group was 78%. So just looking at, you know, the parameters, the changes here with mouth breathing versus oronasal breathing and nasal breathing, there's a significant difference there. It makes sense. Can you have the tongue resting in the roof of the mouth if you're breathing through the mouth? And the answer is no. And if the tongue isn't in the roof of the mouth, where is it going to be? Probably, and more likely falling back into the airway.
So you mentioned some blood gases there, things like carbon dioxide. And a lot of people don't know the relationship between oxygen, carbon dioxide, and blood gas levels. Can you kind of help people understand? And it's something that I didn't really comprehend until I read all the books and the literature and the science behind it. But can you go a little bit into the whole relationship between carbon dioxide, hemoglobin, oxygen?
Yes. So this was discovered back in 1904 by a Danish physiologist called Christian Bohr. And it's called the Bohr effect, B-O-H-R. And basically it states that the carbon dioxide pressure in the blood, it plays a role as a catalyst for the release of oxygen from the red blood cells. So in very simple terms, when we take a breath of fresh air into our lungs, oxygen transfers from the lungs into the blood. And most oxygen in the blood is carried by hemoglobin. So hemoglobin red blood cells, that's responsible for carrying the vast majority of oxygen. 98% of oxygen in the blood is carried by hemoglobin. So you can imagine hemoglobin holding onto oxygen. And hemoglobin will release oxygen from the blood to the tissues in the presence of carbon dioxide and the resultant drop to blood pH. Now, despite that discovery back in 1904, many people believe that it's good to breathe hard. But if you breathe hard, number one is you're not likely to increase the oxygen uptake in the blood. because it's already, the blood is already almost fully saturated with normal breathing. But hard breathing is getting rid of too much carbon dioxide. And it doesn't take a whole lot of hard breathing to get rid of much CO2. One single deep, big breath can blow off between 7 and 16 millimeters of mercury of CO2. And every 1 millimeter drop of CO2 can reduce blood flow to the brain by 10%. Now, it's not that individuals, you know, there's always this thing in breathing. It's not all about carbon dioxide either, but certainly carbon dioxide and the physiology, that's just normal physiological, you know, laws. And that would be based on what's called the oxyhemoglobin dissociation curve. But there's a few things with regards sleep and breathing patterns. You know, it's not just about breathing through the nose, but we need to be looking at, and nobody, doctor, has done any study looking at the application of functional breathing and obstructive sleep apnea. There's been some limited studies on nasal breathing and sleep apnea. There has been one published paper looking at loop gain and how you measure it using breath hold time. But we need to look at functional breathing. What can we do when we change a person's breathing patterns? Well, number one, I would say with anybody with a sleep disorder is learn to breathe in and out through your nose. Number two is that the tongue should be resting on the roof of the mouth. But number three is to change and improve the biochemistry of breathing. And that's all about carbon dioxide. How do you improve the biochemistry of the blood? By through your breathing, you learn how to breathe lightly. And we have to think that, I think the best way to think of obstructive sleep apnea is to approach it the way an engineer would look at a pipe. If you asked an engineer to look at a pipe, that engineer is going to consider the diameter of the pipe, but they are also going to consider flow. Now, typically in sleep medicine, the only thing that's being considered is the diameter of the pipe. Nobody seems to be looking at the fast respiratory rate that this individual might have, the fact that they are mouth breathing is activating the upper chest, and mouth breathing, the resistance to breathing through the mouth is less than the nose. So for example, by breathing through your nose during wakefulness, the nose imposes a resistance to your breathing that's 2 to 3 times that of the mouth. But that's good during wakefulness. It slows down the breath. It's very good for mental state. Slow breathing is very good for the mind. And slow breathing is good to allow oxygen transfer to take place from the lungs to the blood. But during sleep, it's the mouth that imposes a resistance to breathing that's 2.5 times that of the nose. And that's bad. So the upper airway, the anatomy is affected by virtue of mouth breathing. Now, mouth breathing, if we look down at our chest and if we breathe through the mouth, we typically see a connection between upper chest breathing and mouth breathing. Now, we also know that, of course, when we hit 40 and we put a bit of weight on the belly, the problem is that we're not just putting weight on the belly, we're putting weight on the throat, we're putting fat on the fat pads in the throat, fat on the tongue. But what is the implication of having weight on the belly? It impinges the amplitude of the diaphragm breathing muscle. And the diaphragm breathing muscle, and if you breathe with good amplitude of the diaphragm, in other words, simply breathing low, that in turn increases lung volume. And when lung volume is increased, the throat is stiffer and less likely to collapse. So the biochemistry is all about carbon dioxide and having stable breathing. And stable breathing is very important, that gas levels and blood CO2 is normal. We don't want breathing to be waxing and waning, to be all over the place during sleep. Because when it's all over the place, if CO2 goes from too high to too low, well, when CO2 goes too low, the brain doesn't send the signal to breathe. But when the brain doesn't send the signal to breathe, the output from the brain to the upper airway dilator muscles is also reduced. So if we have an individual who is hyperventilating during sleep and blowing off too much carbon dioxide, the activity of the upper airway dilator muscles is reduced. So I'm probably not having a structure here. I might show you a slide if I may.
Sure.
And I hope that this might kind of serve to, so just bear me 1 second here. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at a slide here, which kind of goes through. We can go through the phenotypes of obstructive sleep apnea. And basically, the whole field of sleep medicine has changed in the last 5 to 7 years. Now, traditionally, obstructive sleep apnea was seen primarily as an anatomical issue. But now there's a recognition that only one of the characteristics of sleep apnea is anatomical. And in total, there are four characteristics or four phenotypes or four traits. One is anatomical and three is non-anatomical. Now, what I want to do is I want to show you in terms of the application of breathing, and I'm just waiting for the slide to appear, and we're going to go through each of the phenotypes. So the first one is anatomical, and this refers to the closing pressure at which the upper airway collapses. So it's called PCRIT, or pharyngeal critical closing pressure. Now, how much suction pressure does it take to cause airway collapse? We don't want the airway collapsing at the lowest suction pressure. We want the airway, the upper airway, to be able to withstand a decent enough suction pressure. Now, then you have to ask, well, what is causing suction pressure? We know that as the airway diameter reduces, the negative pressure created during breathing is going to increase. You know, if you're breathing through a pipe, and if we keep the breathing, the flow constant, but if we make the pipe smaller and smaller and smaller, well, the resistance or the pressure, the negative pressure created as we're sucking air through that pipe is going to increase. So if we can open up the airway, we help to reduce the negative pressure inside the airway. And we help open up the airway by having the mouth closed, the tongue resting in the roof of the mouth, and of course, if we are able to bring our mandible a little bit forward, etc. Now, another aspect of this flow, because flow refers to the speed, the respiratory rate, and the tidal volume. How fast do you breathe? And if you breathe fast, typically it's going to increase the negative pressure. So when I think of the anatomy, we have to consider not just the airway, but we need to consider flow. We want to open up the airway. That in turn reduces negative pressure in the airway, but we also want to reduce flow by breathing lighter. That in turn reduces negative pressure in the airway. We have to consider obstructive sleep apnea as a battle. And it's a battle between the negative pressure created during inspiration and the ability of the upper airway dilator muscles to maintain that open airway. So we can influence by changing breathing patterns and starting off with nasal breathing. We can influence the PCRIT. The second phenotype it refers to the stability of the ventilator chemoreflex feedback control. And when you read this at first, you're saying, oh my God, what's that about?
Some big
but
words.
It's actually quite simple. It's called loop gain. And basically this means how sensitive is the individual to increases of carbon dioxide? So for example, when we stop breathing during sleep, during the stopping of the breath as a result of collapse of the upper airways, during the stopping of the breath, carbon dioxide accumulates in the blood. And carbon dioxide continues to accumulate during the stopping of the breath. But when we resume breathing, if we are overly sensitive to the accumulation of carbon dioxide, we resume breathing with exaggerated ventilation. And now we go from a state of high CO2 in the blood, which happened during the stopping of the breath, to too low a CO2 in the blood as a result of the ventilation post-apnea. When CO2 in the blood goes too low, the brain doesn't send a signal to breathe. And when the brain doesn't send a signal to breathe, we have a central apnea. But also, when the brain doesn't send a signal to breathe, the output from the brain to the upper airway dilator muscles is also reduced. And now the upper airway dilator muscles aren't doing their job, and the upper airway is more liable to collapse, resulting in an obstructive event. 30% of the population have high loop gain. And high loop gain can be measured by breath hold time. So for example, in Buteyko, we use control pause, or in Oxygen Advantage, we use the Bolt score. But you can measure your loop gain by simply sitting down and taking a normal breath in and out through your nose and pinching your nose and timing it in seconds. How long does it take until you feel the first desire to breathe? And if you have a control pause or a breath hold time of less than 20 seconds, it would indicate high loop gain. Now, if you have a controlled pause of 10 seconds and you have obstructive sleep apnea, I would certainly suggest you to learn to reduce the chemosensitivity of your body to carbon dioxide, because it is carbon dioxide that's the primary stimulus to breathe. So the objective there would be is to practice breathing a little bit less air during the day in order to reduce the sensitivity of the body to the gas. This in turn increases your breath hold time, and as a result, then your breathing would be more stable during sleep. So loop gain can be both measured with breathing exercises, and it can be also reduced. High loop gain can be reduced with breathing exercises. Number three also impacts 30% of the population. And in actual fact, this phenotype here is the risk, according to a paper published only about 2 years ago in the American Journal of Respiratory and Critical Care Medicine. This is the phenotype which has the greatest risk of mortality, and it refers to arousal threshold. How much pressure will it take to trigger arousal? So if you think of an individual and they have resistance to their breathing during sleep, and the resistance to breathing is changing the pressure inside the airway, and it's also changing the chemistry. Carbon dioxide is increasing and blood oxygen saturation is dropping. But how much or how easy is it for the individual to waken up from sleep, to arouse from sleep? So people with low arousal threshold, they are aroused very easy from their sleep. And it doesn't take much negative pressure or change in chemical to arouse them from sleep. But the problem here is these individuals, they have constant arousals. Now, typically, if you were to look at the AHI index for this individual, it would not be severe. Their AHI will typically be mild to moderate. And also, their blood oxygen saturation doesn't tend to drop below 85%. And the reason being is they continuously arouse from sleep before their apnea gets severe. But it's the continued arousals which in turn is increasing the risk of mortality, according to that one study. Now, you don't want your sleep to be too deep either, because say, for example, you have an individual with high arousal threshold and he is such a deep, deep sleeper. And if he's really ill and he stops breathing during sleep, he might have a prolonged respiratory event because he's not getting aroused from sleep. And this high arousal threshold is the interplay between how likely is he to arouse from sleep and also the activity of the upper airways. So, for example, if you have somebody with poor upper airway muscle responsiveness, that the upper airway isn't, the upper airway dilator muscles are not doing their job effectively. If the person is a really deep sleeper and they stop breathing, and also if the upper airways are not doing their job effectively, well, that individual is likely to have a severe and long apnea, causing blood oxygen saturation to drop and carbon dioxide to increase. So the fourth phenotype, so going back actually to arousal threshold, how can you improve this? Well, typically and traditionally sedatives are used if an individual has low arousal threshold. However, we know that if people have faster breathing, they are typically more likely to be aroused from sleep. And this was discovered by Stanford back in 2017. They identified a new structure in the brain. They first identified it in mice and then in the human being. And they said that this structure in the brain is spying on your breathing. And if you breathe fast, this structure will relay signals to the rest of the brain. And those signals, for example, fast breathing, the signals will include increased agitation of the mind, and also you're more likely to be awoken from sleep. We also know from the limited studies that when individuals switch from mouth to nose breathing, that their sleep becomes much deeper. So nose breathing, slow breathing, and low breathing will help to improve the depth of sleep. There is another aspect here. Many people with, you know, psychological stress have insomnia, and sleep apnea and insomnia often go hand in hand. In one paper, 67% of people with obstructive sleep apnea also had insomnia. The symptoms from insomnia include fatigue, irritability, and cognitive difficulty. But the symptoms from obstructive sleep apnea also include fatigue, irritability, and cognitive difficulty. But how do you differentiate that? Is it insomnia which is causing the person to be exhausted, or is it obstructive sleep apnea which is causing the person to be exhausted? Well, either way, what we want to do is we want to get a better balance between the parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system or response. And an individual who is in high stress, we need to teach that person how to activate better parasympathetic response, how to relax. And we do that by changing their breathing patterns. And it's not by taking this full, big, deep breath, but it's simply by slowing down their breathing. So that breathing is light, it's slow, and it's deep. And we could go one step further by having a combination of light, slow, deep breathing through the nose and pacing it to 6 breaths per minute, which in turn stimulates the vagus nerve, stimulates the baroreceptors, and increases heart rate variability. And heart rate variability is a measure of vagal tone. And it provides us feedback of the functioning of the individual's autonomic nervous system, the balance between their parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system. So slow breathing, nose breathing, and low breathing can help with number 3. Now how about number 4? Number 4 refers to the amount of activity required to get the upper airway dilator muscles to do their job so that they can help to maintain an open airway. We don't have to think of the upper airway muscles during wakefulness. Our airway doesn't collapse typically during wakefulness. But during sleep, these muscles become lazy. So how do we help to improve the functioning of the upper airway dilator muscles so that they do their job to maintain an open airway? We already spoke about nitric oxide. It's not fully known the role of nitric oxide from the nose, but it's thought that it does play a role in the maintenance of muscle tone, that it's also an endocrine messenger. So it plays some role in terms of the functioning of the upper airway muscles during sleep. Now, already I spoke about low CO2. If you have an individual with poor breathing patterns, breathing hard, they get rid of too much carbon dioxide from the through the lungs. The brain doesn't send a signal to breathe. And when the brain doesn't send a signal to breathe, the activity of the upper airway dilator muscle activity is reduced. Now, of course, myofunctional therapy and didgeridoo playing are really harnessing this phenotype, upper airway recruitment. And there's a 50% reduction in the AHI by practicing myofunctional therapy and regular didgeridoo playing in mild to moderate sleep apnea. So I'm just going to stop the share now at this stage. And apologies from the dog in the background. Sorry about that. I'm hoping he's not too contrary.
No, that's great. Wow, there's a lot to unpack there. And for people listening, I mean, I tend to cover sleep a lot on my podcast, obviously, Best Night Ever. And this has been a bit more of a deep dive into sleep disordered breathing. So for people who aren't aware of these things that we're talking about, AHI is the apnea hypopnea index. Normal range is 0 to 4, 5 and over is apnea, 30 and over severe. So that's kind of one of the big references that we use in this industry. And the other is oxygen levels, like he's mentioned. And as we fall asleep at night, if we have poor breathing, we end up holding our breath. We stop breathing, which is sleep apnea. Oxygen levels go down. The lower they go, the worse it gets. Generally, I like to see 90% and above for my patients at night. But I've had patients go down into the 50 and 40%, which is absolutely mind-blowing. Like you said earlier, if I was to put a pulse oximeter on their finger and just say, hold your breath, there's no way that's going to go down to 50% as an awake human. But something bizarre is happening at night where this happens, and it just blows me away. So
I can explain it. Yeah. If you ask them to hyperventilate for 30 big breaths, really hyperventilate for 30 breaths, and then ask them to breathe in, breathe out, and hold their nose, they will hold their breath for such a long time, they can rest PO2 to 50%. However, I wouldn't do it. It wouldn't be safe to ask. So, but that's how you could reproduce it. And just as I make the point, the oxyhemoglobin dissociation curve, you know, if we look at this curve and it's looking at during a stopping of the breath, carbon dioxide is increasing in the blood. And carbon dioxide is causing a reduced affinity of hemoglobin for oxygen, which in turn is going to cause a drop to the SpO2. So when we're reading studies, the studies don't take into consideration the drop in blood oxygen levels as a result of the hypercapnic response that's happening during the breath hold. And it's bizarre because the hypercapnic response is causing hemoglobin to release oxygen. Mm-hmm. But here, oxygen is released throughout the body, including the brain. In actual fact, carbon dioxide is a protective. It's really protective during apnea. On one hand, the individual has stopped breathing. Their blood oxygen saturation is dropping. They're not replenishing it by breathing. But on the other hand, carbon dioxide is increasing to increase blood flow to the brain and cause a right shift of the oxyhemoglobin dissociation curve, so more oxygen gets delivered. However, the increase in CO2 will result in the SpO2. So that's why we need to look at the SpO2 in light of the CO2.
Got it. So we've talked a lot about the negative consequences of poor breathing. I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about the benefits of proper breathing. And this is something you go into in Oxygen Advantage. This is something that I've experimented with breath work. So maybe we could talk a little bit about how we can use this beneficially from a performance aspect in terms of athletics or, you know, biohacking, things like that. And also we could talk a little bit about breath work and how to regulate the breath in a way to maybe tap into the autonomic nervous system. I know we touched a little bit on that with the slow breathing, and that I've done a podcast on coherence and HRV and things like that. I think you hit the nail on the head about 5.5-6 breaths per minute, which is about half what we normally breathe. So I've really focused on slowing down. But let's talk a little bit about Oxygen Advantage and performance and athletics and how we can help hack that.
Sure. I think, you know, many people with faulty breathing have cold hands and cold feet and brain fog, for example. And cold hands, this is just a sign that, you know, with many people, it's a sign that your blood vessels have constricted due to too fast and too hard breathing.
I've always had cold feet my entire life. It's terrible. I have socks on right now.
And, you know, I suppose the best way to practice it is to do the exercises. So, for example, if somebody has a stuffy nose, and once they're not pregnant and they're in relatively good health, to decongest the nose, you hold your breath. And you typically need to hold your breath for about 30 seconds. Now, if you've got panic attacks or panic disorder or anxiety, be very careful doing breath holding because they do activate a fight or flight response. So what I'd say is go very, very easy. But typically to decongest the nose, you take a normal breath in and out through the nose, hold the nose, and you gently just nod your head up and down, holding the breath. And you relax into it, and you keep just gently nodding your head up and down, holding the breath, and then you let go, and you breathe in through the nose, and you wait 30 seconds to a minute, and you do it again. And if you do it 5 or 6 times, the nose will start to open up. Number 2, if you were to practice just sitting into a chair, and you put one hand on your chest and one hand on your tummy, and you just tune into the flow of the breath as it comes in the nose, and the slightly warmer air as it's leaving the nose, and you're focusing on your breathing, and you're gently slowing down the speed of the air to the point of air hunger. So the objective is that you feel air hunger. With this, you're likely to start noticing a number of things. Number 1, you've got increased watery saliva in the mouth. Number 2, you start to feel drowsy. That's a sign that you're tapping into the parasympathetic response, because it's the exhalation that's the driver of the parasympathetic response. So by having a slow and relaxed exhalation, you're able to bring the body into that relaxation response. And this is very important before sleep, because many people, their heads are full of thoughts, they're living in their head, they can't get out of their head. And if their mind is racing before they go to sleep, their mind is racing while they are in sleep and they have insomnia. Mind is racing, we are twisting and turning all night long. So it's very important that we downregulate before sleep. And everybody talks about, you know, wear blue light filter glasses, don't expose yourselves to blue lights, etc. But the real key here is tap into your breathing, but breathe in and out through your nose. Now, 20 years ago, I started taping my mouth. I've continued with it ever since. But I would like to show you a way to do it, because maybe people have children or maybe people, adults are anxious and they're wondering how can they tape their mouth, but without a risk. So this tape here is a tape that we developed, and it is my own tape. So this is not a shameless plug, but it was more that we had a problem that we were trying to solve for many, many years. We would see children in chronic mouth breathers, and we knew that these kids could breathe through their nose. And how do I know that? Because when I bring them into the clinic, I have them with their parents, and usually a few kids, we ask them to wear tape. So we have the kids, when they come into us, 5 or 6 children, and each child wears tape, and we have them do the breathing exercises, and we keep the tape on the kids for about 40 to 50 minutes. So we know then if a child can endure their mouth sealed for 40 to 50 minutes, we know anatomically that the child can breathe through the nose, but we need to change the behavior with the kids. And a couple of years ago, because I used to get frustrated, you know, I'd be working with the kids, going through everything, establishing nasal breathing. We'd have them running, literally running with their mouth closed, and they could do it. Yes, they feel air hunger, which is normal, but they could do it. A week later, they come back in, mouth is wide open again. And I go through the whole thing again. And a week later, they come back in, the mouth is wide open again. And I say, what's going on here? I was focusing too much on restoring breathing patterns from a functional point of view and not enough on changing the behavior. So I said to the parents, every day, I need you to have your child wear tape on their lips for at least a half an hour a day, at least, and increase it then after a couple of weeks to an hour per day. And we had them do that, and it was a game changer. But what could we do about sleep? So this is where this comes in. So the tape is called Myo tape. And quite simply, it's an elasticated tape. This is the adult size. So we stretch it about 40%, 30%. So there's an elastic tension and it's bringing the lips together. But it may also be elating the muscles around the mouth, the orbicularis oris muscle. And the other thing about this is that we have children, you know, typically now, there's this option here as well, especially during wakefulness, but not during sleep. And we had the kids wear the tape for a half an hour, but the problem with that is that the kids can't talk and they don't want to wear it. At least if you have something like this on, and you could make your own if you wanted to, it's an elastic tape. At least with something like this, the child can talk, but also if they forget to breathe through their nose and if they open their mouth, the tape automatically reminds them to get the lips together.
Yeah. So for people who are just listening to this and not seeing it on video, the difference we're talking about is like a 3M, the medical white tape that you would get it as a bandage in an office going yes. across your lips versus the tape that you have, which has a big cutout for your lips and your mouth, but applies a pressure around the mouth to help keep it closed.
Yes, that's correct. But it doesn't work with a beard. We have tried it.
I know. I've got a beard. It's funny. I just did this. I put a post on my Instagram last night and people responded crazy about it. But, you know, for me, I wanted to try it, but I've got this quarantine beard going on here. So it's a little tricky.
It is. Yeah. So, but coming back to, like, I think this is the only way, like, in terms of, I could talk about the advantages of breathing through the nose, but I think it's much better if people experience it.
Yeah.
What did it for me was the night that I woke up feeling refreshed. That did it for me. I knew straight away. But even if you were to do your physical exercise, I would really encourage people, do all of your physical exercise with your mouth closed. You will be so surprised. And yes, initially the air hunger is a little bit stronger, but you keep on breathing through your nose during physical exercise. And in about 6 to 8 weeks, the air hunger diminishes. But we think about it, nose breathing is linked with the diaphragm. Diaphragm breathing and greater amplitude of the diaphragm is linked with the mind. Nose breathing is harnessing nasal nitric oxide. Nitric oxide is redistributing the blood throughout the lungs. This is in turn increasing CO. This is in turn increasing the pressure of oxygen in the blood. Nose breathing during physical exercise increases carbon dioxide in the blood. This is known. It happens during physical exercise when you breathe through your nose, and the increased CO2 allows more oxygen to be delivered to the working muscles. So recovery is better. Nose breathing is protecting the upper airways. It's also protecting the lower airways. So people with asthma, with exercise-induced bronchoconstriction, by breathing through the nose, they can help to prevent their airways narrowing during physical exercise. Nose breathing is not only about moistening and warming the air on the way in, but it traps that heat and moisture on the way out. So it's more economical for the body. We're less likely to be dehydrated when we breathe in and out through the nose. If we think of older people in nursing homes, and I think it's very common for older people to breathe in and out through their mouth, and they are often dehydrated, not necessarily because of a reduced fluid intake, but because of chronic mouth breathing. And chronic mouth breathing, there's a 42% greater water loss breathing out through the mouth than through the nose, 42%. So it makes sense. You're more hydrated, you've got better recovery, you're protecting the upper airways, you're less likely to have bad breath. It's very important for dental health, because if you have saliva in the mouth, it's a natural anti-placate. You know, even just chapped lips. People who have chapped lips are typically mouth breathers. You don't typically get chapped lips if you breathe in and out through your nose, because your mouth doesn't dry. The lips don't dry unless you're passing air across it. So, yeah, I think the benefits are, you know, in terms of energy levels, in terms of calmness, we could even go further. The effect of nose breathing on greater amplitude of the diaphragm, and in turn, the diaphragm breathing muscle, providing posture and stabilization of the spine. For example, people with lower back pain are more likely to be faulty breathers. And we have seen anecdotally that when we've improved breathing patterns with people with lower back pain, it led to a reduction of lower back pain. Sleep, of course, as we spoke about, but anxiety of the mind as well. And I think they're all connected anyway. If your sleep is poor, you're more anxious. And if you're anxious, you're more likely to have poor sleep. And if your breathing is poor, it affects your sleep quality. And if your breathing is poor, you're more likely to be agitated. So one is affecting the other. There's a bidirectional relationship.
Yeah, it's a vicious circle, like you said. I got a couple more questions for you, and then we'll wrap it up. I'm a big fan of yoga, and I go do it a lot. And when the instructor is there, they're saying, deep breath in, deep breath out. And that seems contradictory to what we're talking about here. How what's going on there?
Yes. 1 second. I'm going to show you a book. One moment.
Okay, good.
So this is a book written by a yoga instructor from Falls City, in Seattle.
It's called Restoring Prana.
Robin Rottenberg. And her name is Robin Rottenberg.
Okay.
Now, Robin was teaching yoga for 30 years. 30 years as a yoga instructor. And I think her background was she developed sleep apnea and she developed asthma. She was finding her yoga was giving her some help, but it was only when she started to breathe light. And then she went back to the ancient sutras. So she spent 4 years writing this book. It's 120,000 words. She asked, how did the ancient yogis talk about breathing? And they said not to breathe hard. They said they used the word subtle. They didn't use the word light, but they used the word subtle. We have often heard it used in yoga. For example, in another Eastern tradition in Qigong, Master Chris Pei, he said there are three levels to breathing. The first level is to breathe so softly that the person next to you does not hear you breathe. The second level is to breathe so softly so that you do not hear your breathing. And the third level is to breathe so softly so that you do not feel your breathing. Other sayings are that man's life is not measured by the number of his years, but by the number of his breaths. But if we are breathing hard, we typically breathe fast. And a fast respiratory rate is not reflective of good health. Now, it's not that we should be breathing 6 breaths per minute. But of course, 6 breaths per minute, when we practice it, is a very important, you know, average in terms of improving the functioning of the autonomic nervous system. So, Dr. J, I think in yoga, I think the message got distorted. I actually think that yoga should be practiced with light breathing. And any of my own students, if they ask me, how should I breathe during yoga? I say only one rule. Never hear your breathing in a yoga studio. Never hear your breathing. And if you just follow that rule, you can do all of the asanas. You can do absolutely everything. And you'll even get more benefit of it. Because you'll have, and even if you feel a little bit of an air hunger, that you're doing a really soft and slow breath in, but you're taking hardly any air. So it's focusing and concentrating the mind. But we have to bear in mind, it doesn't make sense to breathe hard, because hard breathing causes too great a loss of carbon dioxide from the blood. Blood vessels constrict and less oxygen is delivered. And, you know, it's amazing. It really is how hard breathing has crept into modern Western society. Look at people who breathe hard and ask yourself the question, are they healthy? The person who's walking the sidewalk and they are out of breath, they are breathing fast, they are breathing hard, not a good sign. And if you were to go for a run alongside an elite athlete, that individual will be breathing light. So with human beings, it's all about the efficiency of breathing. And it doesn't really make sense. I don't have an answer to that. Why has, you know, hard breathing become enshrined? Because, you know.
That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, next time I do yoga, I'm going to actually try tape my mouth shut and see how it works. Because it's so contradictory to what we're doing. But I've never tried just focusing on light. You know, they're always saying the louder they can hear me breathing and exhaling, the more excited the instructor gets. It goes, great job, everybody, you know, but I think we need to switch it around. So, and then speaking of hard breathing, one of the big trends in the whole biohacker world that I enjoy is this Wim Hof style, you know, or sure, holotropic breathing, but that's a whole different ball game when it comes to breath, right? You're trying, yes, to use breath as a means to an end versus a daily thing. It's more of a tool, right?
Yeah. Like the Wim Hof technique is not, it's not how we should be breathing every day, but it's a stressor. So, you know, people are practicing 30 hard breaths, getting rid of a lot of carbon dioxide. They exhale, they hold their breath. They'll hold their breath for quite a long time.
Yeah, because I'll get like 2 to 3 minutes.
CO2. Yeah. And this is what's happening in sleep apnea. So that's why people's blood oxygen saturation is dropping so low. So it's definitely a stressor, and it's causing the body to make adaptation. And in Cox's paper, it showed that it increased epinephrine. And with the increase of epinephrine, that corresponded to an increase of anti-inflammatory mediators and a reduction in pro-inflammatory cells. So in actual fact, it influenced the immune system, that the immune system was better able to cope with inflammation by stressing the body.
Yeah.
So it's probably based on, you know, hormetic changes. You challenge the body a little bit. You're forcing adaptations there. And that's good. And we do breath holding in the Oxygen Advantage. We don't do the hyperventilation because I suppose all of our breath holds are performed by individuals doing physical exercise. So we do sprinting with breath holding. We don't do hyperventilation because if we hyperventilated, the blood oxygen levels could drop too much and the person can pass out. And we don't want that happening because, of course, we're doing everything with physical exercise. Like some of the exercise that was taking a breath in and out, pinch your nose and hold, sprint 40 meters on a breath hold, go back to normal breathing for 30 seconds and sprint another 40 meters, normal breathing sprint. And there's other exercises that we are doing. And again, they're stressors. So I think with breathing, we need to see that there's functional breathing. How do we breathe during our everyday breathing? How should we breathe during physical exercise? How should we breathe during rest? How should we breathe during sleep? And then stressors, ways to impart adaptations, to put the body into it. You know, from our point of view, we're dropping blood oxygen saturation. We're increasing carbon dioxide. It's hypoxic hypercapnic. Wim Hof is hypoxic hypocapnic. CO2 doesn't recover. So there's some similarities and there's some differences. But yeah, stressor versus your everyday breathing patterns.
Got it. That's great. Okay. So we're going to wrap this up here, but I have one last question here. I know we've covered a lot of tips and tricks and methods here, but what would you say, you know, considering all of the research that you've done and all of the people that you've helped, what would be three things that people can do to rapidly make a difference when it comes to their breathing on a day-to-day basis?
Number one, if you wake up with a dry mouth in the morning, start taping. That's number one.
What do you do you think they should have a sleep study or something if they suspect snoring or sleep apnea or any issues like that?
I think it's always good to know your baseline. I have to be realistic here. You know, the CPAP machine works, but a lot of my own students have not been able to comply with it.
They can't tolerate it. Yeah, of course.
And that, you know, that's so, you know, if somebody presents with an AHI of, you know, if it's 20 or if it's 25 or it's 30, I'd be interested in terms of applying functional breathing with nasal breathing and myofunctional therapy and seeing what impact that has by having a follow-up sleep study. Now, and even if, you know, if students are using mandibular advancement, we still apply all of the exercises and the technique because mandibular advancement is anatomical, but changing breathing patterns, we're getting to the non-anatomical phenotypes. And I know from Messineau's paper that he said that, say, loop gain, 30% of the OSA population have high loop gain. They don't respond well to anatomical interventions, including surgery and mandibular advancement. So those individuals with high loop gain, it's very important that we help to improve their breathing patterns. So, you know, I think definitely, like, in terms of the one way, the one thing above all else is that your sleep apnea is resolved. Whether you do it through CPAP, whether you do it through motor advancement, whether you do it through any means, but the number one objective is resolve sleep apnea. How you do it, always bear in mind the importance and the contribution of breathing exercises in that.
Okay. Two and three.
So number two, I would pay attention to how fast and how hard is the individual breathing and measure controlled pause. So it's a very simple measurement. You're sitting down for about 5 minutes. You allow your breathing to settle and then you take a normal breath in and out through your nose. You pinch your nose or you time it in seconds until you feel the first definite desire to breathe. And if you have a low breath hold time, it indicates that you have a dysfunctional breathing pattern. And one paper by a university professor, Kiesel, in physical therapy from Evansville University, I think it's in Colorado, he looked at 51 subjects and his conclusion was that if breath hold time is in 25 seconds, dysfunctional breathing is present. Or if your breath hold time is greater than 25 seconds, if it's greater than 25 seconds, you have an 89% chance that dysfunctional breathing is not present. Now, with an improved breath hold time, your breathing is slower and more likely to be driven by the diaphragm. This in turn helps sleep, but it also helps with physical exercise because individuals with a low breath hold time, they typically gas out too soon. They breathe too hard, they breathe too fast. And maybe some of your listeners are thinking, well, I've been training physically for a long time, but no matter how much I train, I seem to plateau, that I'm not getting those incremental gains. Because our breathing during physical exercise is determined and influenced by our breathing during rest. Our everyday breathing is what's influencing our breathing physics during sleep. So the objective is to improve our everyday breathing. Number three, I think it's really important for the human race not to live stuck in their head. I live stuck in my own head with racing mind. And oftentimes there's not enough of an emphasis here. Our education system teaches us how to think and it teaches us how to reason and to break information into tiny pieces. We are taught how to think, but we are not taught how to stop thinking. It's very important that we pay some attention to what we think about. And especially we realize when we are having self-defeating thoughts, self-critical thoughts, and a lot of our thinking in the human being, a lot of it is negative, it's incessant, it's repetitive. And the one thing that the breath has given to me over the last 20 years has brought me that I was able to tap into the breath to bring a calmness to the mind. And I'm not saying that my mind isn't active. Everybody's mind is active. But I've been able to control it a lot better, a lot more. And in terms of productivity, in terms of energy, in terms of intuitive ideas, fresh and original thinking. We need to have a space between thoughts. And even in terms of family, relationships, you know, when the mind is agitated, we are not just polluting our own mind, but we are polluting the environment around us. We are polluting all relationships that we're having with everybody. But it all goes hand in hand, you know. If you have good sleep, you have calm mind, or at least you have a tendency. Like, people come into me with depression, and I'm talking to them, and, you know, I ask them, how do you feel when you wake up in the morning? They will tell me more. They will tell me that they wake up feeling exhausted. And then I ask, has your doctor ever asked you about a sleep study? And more often than not, the answer is no. And it's because I think the doctor feels that it's the depression which is causing the exhaustion. It's the anxiety which is causing the exhaustion. And maybe we should be wondering, is it the obstructive sleep apnea which is causing depression? And we know that when sleep apnea and insomnia go together, the risk of depression is higher. So mental health has really came to the front of our imagination. But we have to look at sleep and we have to look at breathing. But all too often as healthcare, you know, as healthcare individuals, everybody, we're all in our own little silos and we're not seeing the interplay and the bi-directional relationship between all of these functions. And that's important. And it's very important for children as well, of course.
Yeah, that's a big one there. And I can say, you know, from experience too, is just on a day-to-day level, when the mind starts to wander and you get these negative thoughts and I can see myself, heart rate goes up, breath rate goes up, it becomes a burden to me and it becomes a burden to those around me. Even on a weekend, if I'm out with my family and I start thinking about all these other things, it takes away from my presence of being there. And now we can go down this whole rabbit hole of mindfulness, meditation, and breath work, which we were just touching on here. But it's all interrelated. It's all interconnected. Yes. I think it's very important. I think all three of those are life-changing tips, and I continue to embrace those on a day-to-day basis. So this has been fascinating. We've mentioned a lot of things on here. If people want to learn more about you or your work, we can talk about your books. Is there some websites? What can people do to go down this a little bit deeper?
Sure. For sleep and for anxiety and asthma, the website would be buteykoclinic.com. And that's buteykoclinic.com. And for sports and more kind of performance-based, it's oxygenadvantage.com. And we have Instagram channels as well. We're putting out posts and a lot of science that comes up. If people follow us, they'll see what we're putting out there. And our children's pre-breathing program is completely free. So that's on buteykoclinic.com. So we recorded every single exercise for children. So any child, if the parent wants to sit the child down to understand about the importance of nose breathing, little exercises to open up the nose, all of it is completely free. So they'll get that from the website as well.
Yeah, fantastic resources. I've adopted everything that you've said. It's helped me in my life. I take my mouth, my wife, my kids. We've done the nose unclogging exercise, the nodding your head. And, you know, as strange as it may sound, these things work. This technique is real and the impacts are real. So I just want to thank you again for joining me on this. This has been fascinating for me. I hope it wasn't too technical for a lot of people out there, but it all makes sense. And the more you start to pay attention to it, the more your awareness picks up on what's going on and how things are connected, the more you can benefit from making the changes. So Patrick, thank you so much for joining me. It's been a pleasure. Like we talked about off mic, whenever you're in LA, let me know and look forward to getting together with you.
Thanks very much, Dr. J.
Well, you made it to the end. Thanks again for listening. Hopefully, I didn't lose too many of you with some of that technical science. And you know I can geek out all day long with Patrick, but I hope you were able to get a few key takeaways from his incredible knowledge and experience. In case you want to get some of his special mouth tape, it's called MyoTape, and it's at myotape.com. And if you want to learn more about me, you can check out sleepbiohacker.com or follow me on Instagram at sleepbiohacker. And that's it for this one, folks. As always, I hope you have the best night ever.
This broadcast is for informational purposes only. Statements and views expressed in this show are not medical advice. The show, including Dr. Jay Khorsandi, the co-host, guest, and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of any information contained herein. Opinions of the guests are their own. We do not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests, nor do we make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. If you think you have a medical problem, please consult a licensed physician.